Station number 27053.
Mr. Dre, Reel 4. We're talking about your training with the Air Training Corps, based at Newton Abbot between 1942 and 1943.
Yes, that's right.
We talked about the drill, the Morse code. What other training did you have with the
aircraft observation was another one quite important to us. That was quite interesting, really, because we would be in a lecture room with aircraft flashing up on the screen, and we had to sort of write down what aircraft we thought it was. And I wasn't too bad on this one. I used to score quite well on aircraft observation.
Recognition,
it would be. And both German and British we had to have. And so it was quite good. I remember that when we actually saw an aircraft, the first one, a German, they brought into Newton Abbot down there in the butter market a Messerschmitt 109. Had it assembled complete, like it had been brought down, and all the air cadets went in free. And we had, it was for air cadet night when we were going in there, and we had RAF officers explaining all the workings of this thing. That was quite good to see it. Later, it was open to the public, who paid sixpence to go in and see it, and all the money went to what they call war weapons. It was a fund they rose for, but it was in the Buchter market for about a month, I suppose, and then went somewhere else.
What did you think of it when you saw it? I mean,
it was wonderful, you know. To think that, you know, one of the enemy had sat in there and flown it, and but of course, being boys like we, you know, ain't so good as a Spitfire sort of thing, comparing it in their minds. Well, that summer of 1942. We were asked, some of the bigger boys in the ATC, if we would go up to camp for a fortnight at an airfield at Horrebier, and that's near Yelverton, up on the moors.
How do you spell it?
Horrebridge. I think it's Horrro Bridge. Horrebridge.
And that's near Yelverton.
Near Yelverton. And this was
at Yelverton.
Yelverton, yeah. It's just the other side of Princetown. It was the air defences of Plymouth, really. Although up where the airport is, they had a few fighters. But this was a wonderful airfield. Every day in Nussley, for quite a long while in 1942, there used to be a plane. Among this aircraft recognition, they played us tapes of sound, so that we could identify planes by sound. And one of them that I always remember that used to fly over was a Walrus flying boat. A Walrus amphibious thing, this is. And it had propellers reversed. They were a pusher. They weren't in front of the pulling the plane long. They pushed. And it had a beautiful singing noise. And it used to fly over. And I imagine it was flying between Plymouth and Bristol, because it used to flow to and fro like a bus service. Not all day, but every day almost it went over. So I knew it by sound, and I knew a lot of these aircraft by sounds. If I heard one today, I'd know a Spitfire if she was up there. Well, we went up on this airfield, and what our duties were to do, it was one to introduce us to Royal Air Force way of life, of course, because we were the bigger boys, you know, that were moving up to join the Royal Air Force. But we'd done a certain amount of fire watching. In other words, we walked around the camp and make sure that no fire, or if we'd raise the alarm or try to cope with it if we could. Different little odd jobs we'd done for this camp, besides just being on the camp up there. But it was quite good, it was really, because they had such a variety of aircraft. They had Spitfires and Hurricanes. They had Blenheim bombers. They had this Walrus. They had a Lysanders up there. And they had bullfighters. These bullfighters were a night fighting aircraft. They came obsolete fairly quickly. But we had all these aircraft, and we could, they would allow us, I even went in a link trainer, but they put, they allowed us in a link trainer. There's like a pilot that goes in and plays around. They were very good to us, mine, the, these RAF.
Did you have a go in the link trainer?
Yes, oh no, got in and had a go in a link trainer. Yeah, and they took us up on one flight each. And most of us went up in these little Blenheim bombers. It was a twin engine thing. And but they gave us, during the fortnight camp, each boy was given a flip, as we called it, in an aircraft.
And what you were in a Blenheim, were you?
I was in a Blenheim.
Now, I mean, flying then was unusual, wasn't
oh,
it?
Oh, yeah.
What did you think of your first flight?
Oh, it is out of this world. I'd never, when I got home, I must have bored everyone near me to tears, because I never stopped talking about it, really. It was... And it was a Czech pilot, I think. He couldn't speak English, and he's telling us, and we guessed, like between ourselves, it was, if a red light was to come on, we're supposed to jump out. We decided that. I'm sure it wasn't, because we had no parachutes on. And but he was gabbling about something, and they flew us right over Plymouth, where the balloon barrages were. And it was quite interesting. I looked down on all the balloon barrages, and of course, you know, it wasn't so bad as in the Battle of Britain. There was no likelihood, I don't think, of a 109 coming up behind us or anything. But we all had it, and it was quite good food that we had on the camp. It was, I mean, eggs and bacon breakfast was quite regular. So it nearly changed my mind about going in the army.
Well, that's exactly what I was just going to ask you. Did you ever think of joining the RAF?
Not seriously. If I'd have gone in, if I could have been accepted as an air gunner, I might have done. I'm glad I didn't now, knowing 55,000 airmen lost their lives on raids. So, No, I...
So you were tempted a bit.
I tempted a bit, yeah. One, because of the way of life on them. I mean, even the pilots that went over France in action and that came back to airfields later. Even the bomber... I mean, I'm talking about the big bombers raids. If they survived the raid, they came back to blighty sort of thing, to their wives, their sweethearts and their way of life, didn't they? So there was that. If they could survive the raid, they got back all right. But if you're in the army and you're out in Burma, Italy, somewhere like that, you were out there for 3 or 4 months and we had no telephone in home and all that sort of thing. So there was that about the Royal Air Force. I had a brother-in-law went in the Royal Air Force, right in the, he was a RAF VR, a mechanic. They had to work damn hard, mind. They worked long hours on that. He was on a bomber station. So, but he never went abroad at all.
Now, why wouldn't they take you as an air gunner? I mean, I thought they were short of air gunners.
They were, but there'd have been more to the training than that. I mean, they were still getting a lot of boys in them days, older than me, and their squadrons were all over England. They were getting their recruits from. That's where they got most of them from, I should think. The last half of the war were from the Air Training Corps. So, no, I decided we're coming now to the end of 43, and at that time...
Anything else happened? You mentioned there was an accident. Is that an important story?
Mentioned?
There was an accident in 42.
Oh, yes. Yes. You asked me about the roads and all the military vehicles on the move. This is very true. When we were in the Air Cadets, they ran a lorry from Chagford, which is further than Moreton Hampstead again, out this way, and he'd come Chagford, he'd pick up boys. One of the masters out at Chagford School was one of our officers at weekends, and they'd pick up Moreton Hampstead, then Lusley, he'd pick us up, and then not Bobby Tracy, he'd take us straight into Newton. But the boys from Manniton, this village just across the way, went in to Moreton Hampstead, and they were picked up. Well, one young lad there, two of them, they were going back, and another lorry collided with them on a bend somewhere, and they were killed in a lorry, like, you know, drivers just tearing down the road on a bend, and the lorries just, they didn't crash as such, but they scraped one another, and all you had was sort of a frame with canvas over it and a 3-ton lorry and wooden benches to sit on, and I suppose it caught them in the spine, and one of them from Manton was killed. And another one of our boys, again from Widdicombe, which is just over here, the army was here, and the army done a lot of shooting at a range here at Hator. You could hear them all up from Lusley anywhere. You'd hear machine guns and firing going all day during the war. It was quite common there because they were stationed in Newton, that infantry battalions. So they brought them out here for training. And one lad up there, they had mortar drill, you know, firing mortars, 2-inch mortar or 3-inch mortar, I don't know which it was, but he was hoeing turnips. You know, when you plant turnips, you plant them from seed and you thin them out, so space them apart so they mature into decent vegetables. Well, he was doing that and hit one of these mortars that had been fired and hadn't gone off. It detonated and he was killed. So he's a casualty of war, really. His name's not on a war memorial. He's buried in Widdicombe Churchyard there. Poor little devil. He was in the air cadets with us. So there was accidents taking place, not only on the roads, but by, well, they still do to this day. You know, there's sometimes an accident up on the moors when they hit a wartime unexploded missile or something.
We're going through 43. Any other stories about 43 before we come
42.
42, sorry. We're moving towards 42.
Yeah.
Any other stories before we...
Not really that I know of, no.
So what happens next then?
Well, now, just before the Christmas, I decided with two other boys, both a year older than me. I was 16 on December the 15th. December 15th. 1943, I was 16. I said, we're going to go in the army. Yep, okay. They were both 17. Up we went to Exeter. The Castle Exeter was the recruiting office. And I went in on December the 6th, January the 6th, 1944, 6th of January. And I went in and a sergeant said, what's about a boy? I said, I want to join the army, sir. He said, okay. How old are you? I said, 18. Okay. He said, the second boy, how old are you? Now, he was 17, but he was a bit of a rather thin and not quite so robust. And he said, how old are you? He said, 18, sir. He said, I think you better go home and eat your father and then come back and I'll take you. So he was out. Said to the third one, how about you? He said, 18. Okay, so took us in, gave us a medical, said, okay, you can come.
Now, how strict was the medical, would you say?
Not very much at all. Not really. They stripped us down and listened to our heart, looked in the ears, the eyes, give us eye test, asked us to cough, and said, right, it wasn't very strict at all.
And you were underage.
They never asked me for any proof of age, no. And so then we went before an officer and he swore us in. And we were given an allowance and told, in a day or two you'll hear, and you're going to the army. Well,
now you joined for the army.
Yeah. Duration of emergency. We would. That's
volunteered underage.
Yeah.
Now, did you know which regiment?
Yes, of course I did. This officer said to me, "What do you want to go in, boy?" I was the leader of these three. I don't want you to think I'm a bit of a big head, but I was from the adventures with the Home Guard. You can tell that I was a bit of a leader, I suppose, as a boy. So I was leader. So he said to him, I was the number one, you see. What do you want to go in, boy? I said, Northamptonshire Regiment, sir. And I'm in Exeter, Devonshire. So he looked at me a little puzzled for a minute, and he said, why is that, boy? I said, because my father was in it, the First World War, sir. And he said, as good a reason as any, boy, as good a reason as any. And the other boy, of course, he said, well, I'll go with him. So the two of us. So this is the story. We got home and he hadn't told his mother anything about going in the army. So she found out through gossip in the village that him and I were going in the army. So she created a din, and his father got in touch with the War Office and said that he was underage, and they therefore discharged him before he got in. He never went. He had to go a year later because he was conscripted. But I was head of the three, the only one that went.
Now, what did your mother say?
Well, my mother, twice she'd done it. Once she wrote to my, when this had happened, she wrote to my oldest brother and said, he said, oh, he won't hurt. They won't send him abroad yet. Let him go. And so I went into the army.
So she did. She was thinking of objecting.
But oh, yeah.
Told her not to
go. But
what did she say to you?
well, you know, well, it's not going to be all like you think it is, and one thing and another, but not a lot. My mother didn't, not really. She had, bear in mind, I had three brothers in the army already then. And so I went. And I went to Norwich.
Norwich?
Norwich. I went to the Britannia Barracks, Norwich.
Now, when was it you went? Was it in January?
18th.
And tell us about setting off. What did you... You went on your own, I presume?
Went on my own.
It's been quite a journey.
Well, there was a there was another lad from the village that had been called up, and he had got to go to Colchester. And he had been in London and had been on the Underground once or twice. So I went with him, and he went to the same, I think it's Liverpool Street we went from, and he was going to Colchester, I was going to Norwich. Well, it was a day, you know, before I left Lusty in the morning, first train, 8 o'clock. It was dark when I got up to Norwich, but I got out and of the train after negotiating through and got up there. And I said, Britannia Barracks, and someone said to me, it's up on the hill, and it is, and a steep hill above the town. So I hiked up this hill, went in the guard room, and I was feeling a bit miserable by this time, I have to confess. But the sergeant said, oh, okay, and told one of the guards that were there, one of the boys that was on guard, to take me across the way to this barrack room. And away I went in the barrack room. When I got in there, there was nearly all the beds. There was a huge, long, I don't know, offhand, I think it must have been 20, perhaps even more in this big room, beds each side, and there was palliasses, as they called it. We called them biscuits. They were like two squares, about 3 foot square, two of them, and they were piled on top of one another. And on top of that was two blankets. There was boot brushes and one thing another. There was a toothbrush, and various items were laid out on this bed. And so they had to look it through. There was a housemaid, as they call it, housewife. It was a little satchel of sewing equipment for sewing buttons on and one thing another.
So you hadn't been given your kit yet? This was
This was laid out on the bed. So then they came in and the sergeant showed us how to make a bed. Or a corporal, it would have been, come in. Because at the end of the barrack, and this barrack room, there was a little room with glass around it, and the corporal in charge of the barrack, that particular room, he slept in there. So he showed us how to make the bed. We were then told, it's a long while ago, but we were told what time we went to bed, time we got up, and the procedure for the next day. Well, got into these, there was no pajamas or anything in them days, didn't have sheets, it was just coarse blankets. And these biscuits was, and there was a hard pillow thing. So it was an iron bedstead, all uniform along, and you had a tiny locker thing. Each man had a tiny locker beside the bed. So they told us all what happened, and it was getting late by then, of course, because we'd arrived up there. This is late evening. I think they might have got brought into the barrack room, into the room, a Dixie of tea, I seem to remember, or cocoa, and handed her around a cup. There had been a mug among the other things, yes, and a mess tin with a knife and fork would have been there on the bed. So we went to, but we suddenly heard this blasting going off outside, and it's bugle. And it was bugles all the time in that barracks. Well, all the time I was in England, it was we were spoken to by bugles. So in the morning, it seemed like the middle of the night, there was a bugle blowing, get out of bed, you see, and soldiers put words to these bugle calls. I don't know if you've ever heard them. Well, this was get out of bed, you lazy buckers, get out of bed. And this is a bugle, and he'd walk around the barracks, around this huge square, it turned out when I saw it in daylight, huge tarmac square. That was the barrack square, like the way we were going to be square bashing for the...
Well, any of the bugle calls you remember, while we're on it, I know,
Well, only brief snatches of it. When you had to do a guard or anything like that, they used to sing, you may, de- no, c- Come and do a picket, boys, come and do a guard. You may think it's easy, boys, find it's bloody hard. And that was calling the guard out. Then the battalion, to raise the battalion on, fall in A, fall in B, fall in all the company. And they'd keep playing this, and you'd have to double out onto the barrack square, calling the, that's a RSM's parade, usually they called that. There was all sorts of, there was one for sergeant majors, they used to get really wicked, we never sung the words when he was around, and it finished up with something about, you've got a face like a chicken's ass, sergeant major, and he used to get a bit peeved about that, so he didn't sing it very much. And then there was another one for jankers, you know, the men that had been some misdemeanor, they had to stay in barracks, they had to get up before the reveille and go down and report at the guard room, and in the evening. You may have jankers as long as you like, as long as you answer the call. And that was Janker Wallace. And then there was the sick, and I've forgotten all the words. There was two of them. 84, 94, Jones will no go sick no more. The poor bugger is dead. That was one of them. 84, 94, Jones, that's his number, because you only say your first three letters, numbers. Jones, he will go sick no more because the poor bugger is dead. The other one was outside the sick and dying outside. Outside the sick and dying outside. This was boys, if you felt sick, you had to go to the MO, you see. So there was lots of them, really.
The cookhouse?
Oh, yes, I was there. Now, come to the cookhouse door, boys, come to the cookhouse door. Yeah, that was for, and they even had one for male, for the corporals. I don't remember that they did. They had one for fire, because we had a fire squad in a barracks, soldiers that were professional, and they would have, they'd call you by bugle for fire. They called you most things for on a bugle, and you had to because you knew, even if you didn't know these words, you knew the tune, what it meant.
Now, before we go any further, we better establish which unit you're in.
Yeah,
now.
There
you're
we are.
Joining the North.
We're in no regiment.
I was going to say the Britannia Barracks is in
Royal Norfolk.
Depot, isn't
and
it?
In the Royal Norfolk, it was the training depot for the North Ants and the Norfolk Regiment.
Now, did it have a name, this unit?
I was in the 54th, I think it was, infantry training. No, I was a 55th primary training corps. Primary training. And we wore in our caps the lion and the unicorn. You know, the RSM's badge. The coat of arms, isn't it? That's the badge we wore in the hat. Well, then we'd done 6 weeks of that primary training.
I think the best way is to look at it as a typical day, because we can pick up most things about training there.
Yeah.
And you've already started this in one way. You've got to reveille.
Yeah.
Now, what happened then?
Well, you then had to go and wash and so forth, you see. And you had to wash and brush and get yourself ready.
Now, shaving, were you actually shaving?
No, I wasn't. I wasn't shaving. No. I wasn't shaving. I tell you, it wasn't for about 6 months. And one day I'm on parade. Sergeant Major's coming around and said, shave, boy. No, Sergeant. No, sir, I said. I don't shave. He said, you do now, boy. And that was telling me to get this fluff off my face. And from then on, I shaved. But I can distinctly remember him saying, have you shaved, boy? And I said, no, you do now. That was all he said to me. But I didn't shave. To all events, you say this would happen on the first day. We then sort of lurched our way down to the cookhouse to get some breakfast.
Now, this is a big thing I want to talk. I want you to take us through the sort of typical food you'd have all day. I don't want to keep stopping.
No.
If you look at it, I mean, what would you get for breakfast, lunch?
There'd be a wallage of, in the barracks this is, we'd get, you had a choice of porridge or a cereal. You sometimes got a few pieces of bacon, or hard-boiled eggs, a kipper, or a piece of a smoked haddock. That was the general thing. It was a bit repetition, but...
Now, what about the quality and the quantity, the two things that...
Well, the quantity wasn't terribly great, But the army convinced us boys that if we overfed, then we'd be fat and horrible and no good. To keep us hungry was the way to build life. And in the diet we had, we used to have lectures on this by the MO and that, that the dietitians had worked out all the vitamins and so forth we needed to grow to be big, strong men. So we accepted it. If there was a bit of extra, like gash, a bit of spare on the table, we would use to share it. There wasn't much fighting about it. So that was our breakfast.
Now, we'll come to the morning sessions afterwards. Let's keep the food stuff together. What about
lunch?
Dinner or lunch, whichever you
want? Lunch. I took a little bit of while getting used to it because nearly every child in life, their mother's cooking is the best ever because it's the way they've been brought up. They adapt, their taste buds adjust to it, and that's mother's food is the best ever. Well, so it did take a bit of getting used to. We would have a big piece of meat, God knows what it was. It went around rapidly that it was horse and all sorts of things, camels they slaughtered in the zoo. But it was a big chunk of meat, say, boiled potatoes and suet balls, and cabbage was very common. I remember learning a sharp lesson in life very early. I had this cabbage, and as I'm eating, there's a huge green caterpillar, and it had boiled with the cabbage, and it had gone quite hard, like a green sausage. Well, when you're having the dinner, usually the main meal of the day, around an officer comes, orderly officer, and there's an orderly sergeant, and these people, their duty is to go around the barracks and see everything's all right. So this officer came and he said, "Any complaints?" So I said, "Yes, sir, yes, sir." And he said, "What's that?" I said, "There's a big caterpillar in my cabbage, sir." And he looked at me with a grin on his face and he said, "Oh, you're lucky, an extra meat ration, ah," and walked away. And this sergeant growled at me like as much as say, "Why did you say?" But this officer just made a joke of it, funny, and went off. There was this huge caterpillar. But to all events, it was cabbage was boiled cabbage. And it's boiled with a bit of salt and a bit of bicarbonate, nice and green. And I like cabbage. It never put me off. But the way the army done it, they just used to have cabbages in, hardly wash them, chop them up with a desiccate knife and boil it in a Dixie. And that slopped on your plate. It was a bit mucky at times. And what's more, not in Britannia barracks, but I then went to another barracks a bit later. And the cooking was
Britannia.
That was Britannia. Well,
so that'd be lunch. Anything? What about pudding?
Oh yes, there would be pudding. Yeah, they would. They'd give you pudding, and a lot of it is spotted dick, as they called it. This suet with and a bit of custard. They used to make custard up with it wasn't very nice stuff. It was tin milk or something, and custard powder, a rice pudding. Of course, you know, in the army they say. Quartermaster sergeant is in charge of me, and they say, "What's for duff, sergeant?" And he says, "Oh, so and so them, give them rice." And that was so the rice was a predominant dessert that we had in the army. Rice pudding, this suet duff stuff, some form of cake like they'd make up and put a bit of custard on it. By and large, it wasn't too bad, though. You get used to it, and in the end, and being young boys, we were like young dogs. Like, you know, we trained all day and come home hungry. Like, we never refused meals. I tell you, I never saw anyone finicky and refusing, saying, "I don't like that." I mean, when we had days when they had tripe, I mean, I'd never had tripe in my life, but I ate it.
So. Did you like it?
Well, not really, no.